From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Now imagine this scenario. A modified version of the West Nile virus is given to a person with a malignant cancer tumor. The virus doesn't bother or replicate in healthy human cells, but it attacks and then replicates to attack additional cancerous cells until the tumor is no longer there. Does this sound like science fiction? Well, our next guest is Nathaniel Sharping, who's a feature writer for Discover Magazine. He has just written a fascinating article titled, When Viruses Heal. After many years of risky trials and medical advances, a viral cure for cancer could be close to fulfilling its promise. Nate Sharping, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, how's it going? Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here. This is an incredible article. I can't believe I haven't heard about treating cancer with a virus ever before, but it's been going on actually quite a long time. Can you give us the history?
Yeah, the idea of potentially treating cancer with viruses actually goes back quite a ways, as far back as the 1800s, and which is before scientists even knew what a virus really was. But back then, doctors would notice that some of their cancer patients, when they got sick with an infectious disease, would actually see their tumors get smaller and regress. And even though they didn't know what was going on, this kind of prompted some to theorize that there might be a connection between infectious diseases, whatever was causing infectious diseases, and cancer. And so this led them in kind of the ensuing decades, you know, from the early 1900s through to the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, to embark on a number of experiments where they actually infected cancer patients with a number of different viruses. Many of these experiments sound, frankly, pretty horrifying today. Patients sometimes got really sick because, again, they were using live viruses to infect them. Some even died. One trial in the 1970s fed bread soaked in infectious liquid infected with the mumps virus to patients and got them sick. Others used a range of viruses like West Nile virus, mumps virus, dengue, yellow fever, and more. None of them was ever really very effective. You know, we don't have any records of patients in these early trials actually being cured of their cancer. And what we now think was happening was that though the viruses would help kind of attack the tumors, our immune system would clear it out. So the viruses never really had a chance to clear out the tumor. Either that or the patients would die from the virus, which is, you know, obviously something that can happen when we're sick with a virus.
It's interesting, Nate, that you talk about in your article, going back to, this is one trial in 1949, where they gave the hepatitis virus to patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which we now know is a very treatable form of cancer. But you say mm-hmm. the results were mixed, that 7 patients experienced temporary improvement, and at least one died from hepatitis. Well, since 1949.
Yeah, and that,
yeah, it's crazy.
That may have actually been one of the better ones. In many cases, you know, just because, you know, these scientists didn't really understand how viruses worked, how to deal with them, how to treat patients that were sick with the virus, you know, the kind of controls on these studies weren't very good. They were often dangerous. But again, they were working with cancer patients who, because this was, you know, the earlier mid-20th century, there weren't a lot of cures or treatments for cancer at the time. I think many of these patients were probably pretty desperate for anything that could work. So the idea of getting purposely infected with a viral infection may have been frightening, but it also may have felt like your only hope.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking to Nate Sharping. He's just he is a feature writer for Discover Magazine, and he's written an article on When Viruses Heal. Nate, we did a show several years ago on immunotherapy, and one of the things that mm-hmm. I remember from that conversation was The author was talking about in the mid-1800s in New York City hospitals, people were being admitted with cancer, and many of them were dying. Some of them walked out completely cured without any therapies at all. And what they figured out over time was these same New York City hospitals were riddled with what they called St. Elmo's fire, which is a bacterial infection. And that bacterial infection was putting people's immune systems into gear. And in some cases, it fought the cancer. And I find this whole thing fascinating and how the whole thing evolved. And we had a slash and burn strategy for many years. And now immunotherapy is really coming back into its own. It's pretty exciting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And, you know, if we fast forward to the present day with oncolytics, immunotherapy was actually kind of the big breakthrough that's allowed oncolytics to work. They work in tandem. You know, as you may know, immunotherapy is kind of based on these drugs called checkpoint inhibitors. And what they do is our body's cells, including immune cells, have these proteins called checkpoints on their surfaces. And they play a really important role in our bodies, basically by making sure that our immune cells don't attack the body's own cells, which would obviously be bad for us. But cancer cells co-opt this mechanism by also displaying these checkpoints, which means that our immune systems, which should be watching out for things that could hurt us, are effectively told to stand down when they encounter a tumor. And so checkpoint inhibitors, they block these checkpoints on the cells, which frees immune cells to find and attack tumor cells. Immunotherapy basically lets the body fight cancer itself. But the problem even today is that the body isn't always good enough at doing this. Many immunotherapy drugs aren't effective in everyone. And one of the reasons for this is that there simply aren't enough immune cells around to fight tumors effectively. And that's where the viruses or, you know, perhaps bacteria can come in. Our bodies have spent millions of years evolving defenses against viruses, so they're pretty good at it. When a virus gets recognized by our body, we'll immediately mobilize a swarm of immune cells to rush to the scene and start fighting it. So if you need a bunch of immune cells to help kill a tumor, a virus is actually a pretty good way to do it. You know, when you inject a virus into a tumor, it essentially becomes infected tissue, and that's a signal for the body to send a bunch of immune cells there to help, you know, mount a defense. And if it happens to be tumor cells, then they will also kill those tumor cells, and that can help fight cancer.
Well, let's unpack that just a little bit. It's very interesting. We have this sophisticated immune system that's evolved over the years, and we're getting sick with cancer that's also evolved over the years. And what you're saying is that cancer cells depend on a unique cloaking mechanism to survive. They actually cloak this automatic off switch so that the tumor cells continue to evade the immune cells. Is that basically it?
Yeah, that's essentially it. I think cloaking mechanism is kind of the right word. It's something that's been co-opted by tumor cells. And the immunotherapy drugs, they turn off this cloaking mechanism. They, you know, essentially a tumor cell will pop up on the radar screen of our immune system when we add these immunotherapy drugs. So when you add an oncolytic drug, which is essentially just a virus or a virus that's been a little bit genetically modified to be more effective or more safe to us, they can work in tandem to bring a lot of immune cells to the scene of a tumor, you know, and then allow those immune cells to do their job and start wiping out the tumor cells.
Boy, it is such a... And it shows so much promise, this whole world of using oncolytics. And I'm sure that with precision medicine, we're figuring it out more and more. And that's maybe a question I have. And I wanted to ask you the story about Frank Nielsen in Boston. He's got a big tumor. He's got a melanoma on his scalp. How do they decide which virus to insert or inject into that tumor?
Sure. Yeah. So Frank Nielsen, who is the patient who I talked to for my story, he got a drug called T-Vec, which is the brand name Imlygic. It's made by the pharmaceutical company Amgen, and it was approved by the FDA in 2015. And it's actually so far the only oncolytic drug to be approved for use in the U.S. So when doctors were deciding what to use, they didn't really have much choice. And T-Vec right now is only approved for melanoma patients like Frank. It's a modified herpes virus, and it's had several edits that either delete genes or increase the expression of various genes to make it a little more immunogenic, which means more stimulating to the immune system, and to help it preferentially target tumor cells so it's not going after healthy cells.
Okay, so then is that T-VEC virus, modified herpes virus, which sounds a little bit obviously strange to have injected into your body because it's something we really try to avoid. Let's see, does it always pair up with the immunotherapy drug called, Keytruda?
Keytruda. Yeah, that was what they were using in Frank's case. I don't think you'd need to specifically always use the drug Keytruda. I know Keytruda is a more common immunotherapy drug, so I think it was just a good option for them to use. You know, there's a number of immunotherapy drugs, and at the moment, some of them are only kind of indicated for specific kinds of cancers. So I think in that case, it was just that Keytruda was a good one to use for Frank's specific kind of cancer, which was melanoma. But again, it was kind of the combination of the oncolytic drug and the immunotherapy drug that allowed him to be so effective.
You know, Nate, when I think about all the work that was done in the 1800s and the early 1900s and getting us to where we are today, it's just so exciting. Lynn and I see this example played out almost every week where the scientific process is not perfect, but it certainly works well. When you think of all the tireless work and trials that went into this over time, we just wouldn't be where we are today without what came before us. And it's a real nod to the scientific process, I think. And we see it all the time. I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, it kind of speaks to how various perhaps unrelated discoveries can kind of build on each other. You know, oncolytics wasn't really a viable field or a viable kind of treatment until we discovered immunotherapy drugs. And, you know, immunotherapy is obviously also a big thing in the field of cancer. The co-discoverers won the 2018 Nobel Prize in Medicine for it. It's showing a lot of promise. And now we might be able to add oncolytics on top of that and make it even more effective.
And I want to just go back to checkpoint inhibitor drugs just for a moment, because mm-hmm. you had written in the article, and I think this is interesting as well, that checkpoint inhibitor drugs are effective in only a small percentage of patients, but when you add in a virus, that percentage can double or triple. So it's these combinations of therapies that they're showing the most promise, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oncolytic viruses by themselves aren't typically very effective. There was one case in 2014, a woman named Stacy Erholtz got just an oncolytic drug. It was basically a massive dose of the measles vaccine, and that did end up, you know, causing her cancer to go into regression. But it's likely that cases like her are outliers, and we're going to need to combine oncolytics with immunotherapy drugs in the future for them to be effective.
Okay, so going back to Frank Nielsen, he's got the melanoma on his scalp. He gets the injections. 2 years later, he is still cancer-free. And I just wanted to mention that you talk about in your article how his tumor was growing so quickly, there was not, I don't know, the chance or the time to be able to incise it or remove that tumor. So he was, you know, he was pretty desperate at this point. Can the average person go down to, say, the University of Utah Medical Center and say, well, I have a melanoma, I'd like to try some oncolytic treatment?
Well, if you're a melanoma patient, you may actually be able to. Like I said, T-VEC is only approved for use in melanoma right now. There's a number of other clinical trials right now examining various viruses for use in various kinds of cancer. You know, there's hundreds of oncolytic trials going on right now. Most of them are smaller phase one and phase two trials, you know, so maybe a few dozen people, not many, kind of just assessing the safety and the efficacy of these drugs. And it means that we're kind of in the pipeline right now for oncolytics. It's been, I think, broadly recognized as a potentially effective treatment for a lot of different kinds of cancers. But what scientists are doing right now is trying to find better viruses and make the viruses that they do have better by, you know, manipulating them, engineering them to be more safe to use, more effective to use, and matching those viruses up to different kinds of cancers.
Nate, can you help me understand still how some of these viruses don't end up attacking the whole body and making you really sick from the virus itself. I'm still not quite there in that understanding.
Yeah, right. And that's something that kind of hamstrung these early trials. We didn't have the ability of the understanding of how viruses work inside our bodies to keep patients safe. We do know now that some viruses preferentially infect cancer cells. Cancer cells have a few things that some viruses like. They have a very high metabolic activity. They reproduce rapidly. So viruses will kind of naturally tend toward cancer cells. But obviously, that's not enough. And so today, a lot of the work around oncolytics is focused on making them safer. And that typically involves genetic engineering. Scientists are exploring genetic tweaks that can allow viruses to only replicate in cancer cells. We know of a few specific genes and genetic pathways that we can turn on and off so that when a virus gets inside our body, it will only replicate and spread inside of cancer cells. There's a few other things that are helping to make it more effective, like some viruses are being modified to be more immunogenic, which means they'll call more of these immune cells to the scene to just nearby a tumor to do their work. And one thing scientists are also trying to work on is getting to the point where we can inject oncolytic viruses by an IV, which is something we can do in some cases right now, but these viruses often have to be injected directly into a tumor, which, you know, doesn't work if a tumor has gone metastatic and spread or if it's a cancer of the blood, say. So getting to the point where we could just inject a virus into the bloodstream and allow it to find tumor cells, preferentially infect those and wipe it out without affecting healthy cells in the body is something that's still a goal for scientists in the field right now.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Nate Sharping from Milwaukee. He's a feature writer for Discover magazine. Let's take a look at that last thing that you said in a little bit more detail. There are cancers, it's very challenging, that have tumors and they're hard to get to, or it's possibly spread throughout the body. So this would really be an important piece of all of this to be able to effectively inject through an IV, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Like going back to Frank Nielsen, the patient in my story, he was lucky in that his cancer was on his scalp. It was really directly accessible, but it was still kind of a grueling procedure for him. At one point, he was getting up to 70 separate injections directly into his scalp. You know, he said he'd go home with his head swaddled in bandages and spend the night fairly sick from getting injected with the virus. And that did ultimately pay off. You know, after a number of rounds of treatment, he saw the tumors start to regress and get smaller, and it got to the point where they were able to wean him off the treatments. And like you said, 2 years later, he's still free of cancer. But yeah, not everyone's so lucky. Not everyone has a tumor that's easily accessible or, you know, in just one place. And so getting to the point where we could give someone an oncolytic drug via an IV would be a much better and more effective way of kind of implementing this treatment.
And there are so many patients that don't live close to a metropolitan area that has the class of hospitals that Boston has. He came from central Massachusetts, had to come out every 3 weeks or so, according to your article, and he felt pretty sick after all this. It would be a lot easier if he could stay at his hometown out in the country and just go to a local doctor and receive that IV that is prepared by the hospital in Boston. So there's a lot of pluses to this, to making it easier for people that are suffering.
Right. Yeah, I think that's certainly something we could see in a couple of decades, but a lot of the fundamental work, I think, is still ongoing to assess various viruses, assess various ways of engineering these viruses to make them safe, and kind of matching up different viruses with different kinds of cancer.
Nate, you had talked with us previous to the show and said that there was a lot that you weren't able to include in this article that you felt really interesting. What? Give us a little sample of what that was.
Well, I think a lot of that was just the history of oncolytics. There was a fascinating paper co-written by Stephen Russell, one of my sources for the piece, talking about the history of oncolytics. It's really comprehensive and was really fascinating to me. One of the things I wasn't able to talk about was some of the ethical issues around these treatments back in the early and mid-1900s. There was a pair of researchers by the name of Chester Southam and it was Alice Moore. They were really excited by this idea of using viruses to treat cancer. They did a number of trials, but they also transplanted human tumor cells into healthy volunteers so that they could then, you know, test these viruses out on them. Something that even at the time was harshly criticized and is today widely seen as unethical, you know, purposely giving people cancer, obviously isn't ethical and not something we should be doing. Yeah. And that kind of cast a shadow over the field for quite a long time. And that, along with some other developments in the cancer field, is part of what shut it down for so long. It wasn't really until the 1990s that we saw any kind of renewed interest in using viruses to treat cancer. And it wasn't until, you know, the late aughts and the early 2010s that we even saw any kind of advancement in the field. So it really made me appreciate how long it can take sometimes for an idea to gestate or for scientific advancements to come to fruition. You know, this was kind of, it started with scientists noticing something interesting, you know, which is, I think, often how scientists start their work. They notice something that's odd or that doesn't seem right, and they investigate it. And that's, when it comes to oncolytics, that's something they were doing as far back as the late 1800s, and it took over a century for it to become something that's useful. But, you know, again, today it's something that could be really valuable and really helpful to us. So it was ultimately worth it after all that time.
I'm curious, Nate, if there has been any research over the last year and a half with so many people with the coronavirus, if there has been among cancer patients any quelling in their cancer if they are also suffering from coronavirus.
Oh, you know, I wish I could answer that. I actually don't know if the coronavirus has turned out to be helpful to cancer patients. You know, I would say I wouldn't encourage anyone with cancer to go and seek out a coronavirus infection, but
definitely unfathomable for any of us to imagine being purposely injected with coronavirus at this point.
Right.
Nate, you're in pretty high demand for writing these feature articles. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a few pieces for Discover's Year in Science issue. It's something they do at the end of every year, covering the biggest and most exciting science advances of the past year. I'm covering genetics for them, so I'm covering a few of the most recent advances in genetics. Among them is scientists finally completing the human genome. You know, it was initially sequenced in 2003, but it actually wasn't fully done. There were some regions that we just weren't able to get to, that we weren't able to get. And so scientists have finally come close, almost. They're almost there. There's, I think, a few, you know, tenths of a percent they weren't able to get to, but we finally almost sequenced the human genome. So that's something I'm in the process of reporting right now that should be exciting. I'm also writing about the first use of CRISPR in space to edit cells. You know, CRISPR is a powerful gene editing tool that has been around for a few years now and is obviously there. Important in the medical field. Astronauts on the International Space Station recently carried out an experiment where they used CRISPR to edit cells in space, which is, I think, an exciting step forward for the technology and for human spaceflight.
Yeah, it sure is. Let me ask you this. As you conducted your research for this article, what surprised you the most?
I have to say it was the history of oncolytics. I didn't really know about this fascinating, you know, often gruesome history of research into oncolytics that dated back for decades and over a century. And, you know, like I said before, it really just made me appreciate how long it can take for scientific advances to really come into their own. And, you know, the benefits of sticking with it, I guess, or revisiting old ideas that maybe didn't pan out at the time. You know, new technology can enable so many things, can enable things that were once thought impossible or foolhardy, perhaps, as was the case with these virus trials.
Yes, absolutely. Well, our guest is Nathaniel Sharping. He's a feature writer for Discover Magazine. The article that he's just written is called When Viruses Heal. That's what we've been speaking about today. You can look it up, and it's really just fascinating. Nate, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thanks to both of you. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks, Nate.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.